Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today we have a informational meeting on amnesty experience in other states, and also a public hearing on an amnesty bill. So we will open the informational hearing at this time.
Madam Chair, we have asked the folks from Sallie Mae to come in and talk with you about the experience they've had in administering amnesty programs around the state. They've done a number of them, and there's been a lot of amnesty programs around the country over the years. So they're going to talk about the experience that they've had in other states, kind of some of the policy issues that come up to kind of begin to set up a framework for you to talk through the key elements in an amnesty program. The Senate committee played the lead in 2005 and proposing an amnesty program, passing a bill onto the House, and that's basically what 880 is. So this is intended to be background for you and try to get some of the knowledge that the Sallie Mae folks have garnered over the years and their experience, and begin to look at some of the issues around an amnesty program.
Okay, and committee, we invited these folks to come and tell mm-hmm. us. They do amnesty programs. They administer amnesty programs in some of these states, and will tell about their experience. But I just want to make clear that they are not here to market us. They're here to inform us today. So welcome.
So, Madam Chair, we have Steve Hyman and Jack Frazier here. And we also have the background the material that they put together for you. It's in your packet.
Okay. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiscom here for Sallie Mae Corporation, and we're all pleased to be here today. Thank you for your introduction and for your invitation to appear here to provide some testimony on tax amnesty programs around the country. My role is simple today. I wanted to make sure you knew that I was affiliated with the gentleman to my right. They are to my right, Steve Hyman, Vice President for State Affairs for Sallie Mae, who has traveled here from the East Coast and enjoys the sun today, I would say. To Mr. Heyman's right is Jack Frazier, Vice President for Operations for Contingency Services for Sallie Mae Asset Performance Group. Also here behind us is David Lind, National Account Executive for Sallie Mae. He was based in Seattle and is a resource to you perhaps a little closer than either Mr. Hyman or Mr. Frazier. We do have a presentation for you today, which I think is at your desks, and we'd be pleased to go through that, Madam Chair, but as well, if you have questions along the way, I know my colleagues well enough to know they'd be don't mind interruptions at any point when you have a question. So, with your leave, we'll proceed. And Mr. Hill.
Okay, if you'd identify yourself for the record,
sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve Hyman, Vice President, State Affairs for Sallie Mae. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Thank you for inviting us to come and share our experiences about tax amnesty. As Mr. Fiscom mentioned, I'm joined here at the table by Jack Frazier, who's our Vice President of Operations in our Contingency Services Group, which is part of Sallie Mae's division called the Asset Performance Group. I'll talk a little bit this afternoon about Sallie Mae, but before I do, I want to just emphasize what the Chair and Mr. Warner said, which is we do not at Sallie Mae have a position on whether or not the state of Oregon or, frankly, any state ought to or ought not to do a tax amnesty program. That's a policy decision for you as lawmakers and for the executive branch to make that determination. What we hope to do is to be able to inform the committee about our experiences, about what's going on in other states. So this afternoon, what I'll do first is tell you a little bit about Sallie Mae, so you have some context for our conversation this afternoon. Talk a little bit about what we see and have seen in amnesty programs across the nation over the 25 years, or plus 25 years that states have been doing tax amnesties. Jack will give you a little bit of detail about our experience in particular in two states, in Indiana and in Oklahoma, and how we were able to help those states achieve remarkable recovery of uncollected receivables. And finally, we'll provide you with a number of policy considerations for you to think about and to discuss as you formulate policy here in Oregon. If you went to college or you have students in your family who are in college, you probably know Sallie Mae for what its original business was, which was providing student loans and access to higher education. Sallie Mae is the number one saving, planning, and paying for college company. We've helped about 21 million families pay for college since Congress created us in 1972 as a government-sponsored enterprise. We've been a publicly traded company since 1984, but left behind our government-sponsored charter in 2004, so we're a fully private company. What that's enabled us to do since the late 1990s is to get into other types of businesses. While people know us either for our work in providing student loans or for the work of one of our subsidiaries, UPromise, in providing 529 savings plans, what most people aren't as aware of is that a third of our employees are in the assets performance group of Sallie Mae. We currently have over $40 billion of defaulted and delinquent assets under management. We are a leading provider of asset recovery services to federal, state, and local governments, as well as business. And we are pleased to count among our clients the federal government, where we provide collection services to the U.S. Department of Treasury on all of their non-tax assets, to the Internal Revenue Service as one of two companies that working with the Internal Revenue Service on a collection project for them, and for the U.S. Department of Education, where one of our subsidiaries, a company called Pioneer Credit Recovery, is the top-ranked collection agency for the U.S. Department of Education, and they have a $17 billion book of business that we work on with other companies. We have... I guess I should also say a word that in our student loan world, we're sort of the hometown team here in Oregon, because 30% of all student loans made through the Federal Family Education Loan Program go through Sallie Mae. So we make a lot of student loans to families here in Oregon, and we're pleased to be a partner with Oregon schools in that regard. If I can turn now to a little bit of background about amnesty. The first amnesty was done in 1982 by Arizona, of which we have recorded history, that is. There have been 41 states, plus the District of Columbia and New York City, that have done major tax amnesties. There are 80 such projects that have taken place since the early 1980s. They tend to come in waves. We saw the most recent economic downturn prior to our current challenges came in 2002-2003, and what we saw in that climate was that there were 19 states that conducted tax amnesty programs. More recently, in 2008, there were two tax amnesty programs. The states of Nevada and Oklahoma conducted tax amnesty programs. And so far in 2009, and it's a moving target, you can see, because in my prepared written statement, I said there were five. Actually, the governor of New Jersey is about to sign the sixth one into law this week. Six states have authorized tax amnesties. And they vary widely in their scope and in the way the states will administer them. In Alabama, in Arizona, and Massachusetts, those are all programs that are going to take place in the current fiscal year, FY08, for those states ending June 30th, which means they will take place in the April to June timeframe. Those three are more limited in scope, more akin to, frankly, what's in Senate Bill 880. They are more like non-filer programs, trying to identify those individuals or businesses that have tax obligations but have not filed any paper. In Connecticut and New Jersey, those are more general tax amnesty programs where all delinquent and identified taxpayers are eligible to participate in those tax amnesty programs. Those are also programs that will run before June 30th of this year. Virginia has authorized a tax amnesty program that will be for the FY09-10 fiscal year, and that is also a general tax amnesty. I can say that there are a number of states that are considering it. As you may be aware, there are only 9 states that have not done tax amnesties, obviously including Oregon. In Delaware, the newly elected governor there, Jack Markell, one of his campaign pledges was to do a tax amnesty in Delaware. So we expect that they'll see some action in Delaware. But there are a number of states, Madam Chair, that are considering tax amnesty programs in 2009.
To your knowledge, have any states done it more than once?
Yes, Madam Chair, there a number of them have done multiple tax amnesties. In fact, in New Jersey, which is just getting ready to undertake one, they've done one almost every 5 years over the last 15 years.
Okay, thanks.
And we'll talk a little bit about some tools and some policy considerations that you can consider, because when you're a state like New Jersey and you've done multiple tax amnesties, obviously the name of the game in revenue collection is compliance, and you want to make sure that as you if you implement a tax amnesty, that you enhance your compliance and don't do anything to adversely impact it. I want to turn now, if I can, briefly to our approach to tax amnesty and what's different about it. And you have before you a four-page handout that provides a little bit of what I would call the summary of the results in Oklahoma and Indiana. And I'll ask Jack in a second to give you a little more detail. But if you look at page one of the color handout that you have before you, you'll see that in Indiana, their original policy goal, the legislature came up with, was about $65 million in receivables. They ended up at the end of that project recovering $255 million, and we'll talk a little bit about how they did that. It was a 60-day program, and it was a general tax amnesty that ran from mid-September to mid-November. On page two, you can see the summary of the recently completed Oklahoma tax amnesty project. In Oklahoma, Governor Henry's original budget proposal contained a budget item that would have recovered about $22 million. During that eight-week amnesty, which was also in mid-September to mid-November in 2008, to date they have recovered $115 million. The difference between these two amnesty programs, which we were involved in with those two states, and what I would classify as more traditional tax amnesties is the approach. In a traditional tax amnesty, legislature passes a bill, governor signs it into law, they put up a toll-free number, and to the extent that there's been websites available, they put up a website. They may do some paid media and some earned media through press releases, certainly notify the CPA community and the legal community about the opportunity for tax amnesty, and then potentially hire some temporary staff to assist the department in question. And then they wait for the phone to ring. The approach that we took in Indiana and Oklahoma, which is what led to, you know, four or five times the recovery of the original estimate, was a more proactive approach. Not only was there a paid media campaign that was done independent of our effort, but there was, as you can see in the summary documents you have before you in Indiana, over 1 million different telephone attempts, including 1 million outbound calls and nearly 250,000 inbound calls, which for many states can be more inbound calls than a typical state might handle in a given calendar year. There were 700,000 pieces of targeted mail designed to make taxpayers aware of the opportunity to come into compliance. And you'll see similar metrics in Oklahoma. But the combination of the outreach effort directly into taxpayers' hands, the media, the calling, the telephone, the direct mail, all helped generate remarkable returns to those states. So I'd like to ask Jack Frazier to say a few words about what we did in particular, because Jack's team is the team that actually executed the project on a day-to-day basis, worked on a day-to-day basis with the state departments of revenue, and can speak to the what made that project unique.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Really, where it all is.
Can you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, I absolutely can. My name is Jack Frazier. I'm a Vice President of Operations and Contingency Services within Sallie Mae's Asset Performance Group. As Steve alluded to, the great success we had with our partnership with Indiana and Oklahoma, you know, the question really comes out, how do you make all that happen? How does it work? And it really starts with developing customized strategies really geared around maximizing dollars returned to the state. In any tax amnesty program, the central purpose of a contact campaign is to support and enhance the activities surrounding the tax amnesty program. And they include raising awareness that the program actually exists and increasing a positive response and participation during a highly compressed time period. To achieve those goals, we typically perform some pretty extensive skip tracing activities to locate taxpayers for whom the state does not have current contact information, such as telephone numbers or addresses. We segment and prioritize the accounts. We send targeted mail that is reviewed and approved by the state prior to us putting those letters into production. We make outbound telephone calls consistent with scripts that have also been mutually agreed upon between us and the state. And during all this, we field quite a few inbound telephone calls. Additionally, we process payments, we conduct account resolution activities, and finally, we provide data cleansing. The success of our public-private partnerships also depends on a well-trained workforce, tailored to meet the specific requirements and objectives of the program based on feedback and direction from the state. We spend a considerable amount of time developing training material, and we also ask the states that we partner with to review that training material to make sure it is accurate and it meets the needs of the state with a particular tax amnesty program. We feel that it's critical that a private sector partner be committed to maintaining awareness to government and industry regulations. And to that end, we have established comprehensive privacy and safeguard policies and procedures for use with all of our public sector clients. Sallie Mae's Asset Performance Group has a proven record of maintaining the confidentiality of taxpayer information, and we are dedicated to continuing to protect that data. By way of example, we perform random telephone monitoring during all shifts to ensure our staff is adhering to the highest performance and ethical standards. We have also developed and implemented a formal complaint process to ensure that taxpayers and the state have formal process to resolve any customer satisfaction concerns. At this point, I'll pass it back over to you, Steve, to talk about some policy considerations.
Thank you, Jack. As I said, there are a number of different policy considerations that every state that's contemplating a tax amnesty needs to weigh. Jack just gave you some of the operational issues and things that need to take place. But before you even get to the operational issues, I would say there are probably 8 different policy considerations. There are probably more that you can think of, but let me give you 8 to start with as you consider this issue. The first is, of course, timing. When is the opportune time for a state to conduct a tax amnesty? If you look at the list of states and the tax amnesties they've conducted, you can see that states have done them successfully at different times during the calendar year. The vast majority of those tax amnesty projects, however, have been in the fall time frame. Obviously, it goes without saying that state departments of revenue are quite busy in the January to May time frame. They're busy all the time, but they're particularly busy processing taxpayer returns during tax season. Moreover, taxpayers are focused on paying their taxes during that time period. And so what we found in both Indiana and Oklahoma that the opportune time was that window between Labor Day and Thanksgiving. Labor Day, everyone's back in theory from the family vacations, kids are back in school, and you're before the holiday season. So people are really focused on activities that are more what I would describe as business activities as opposed to more leisure activities. So the timing, you'll see the majority of states have done them in the fall time frame. We think that's the opportune time. The second policy issue is what's the optimal duration for a tax amnesty program? Again, the states vary. You see a couple of the ones that are going on this spring are shorter 30 or 45-day amnesties. Part of that is being driven by the state's desire to get the revenue in the door during the current fiscal year. Oregon is not unique in the challenges it faces in its fiscal condition. Many states are facing similar challenges. And so many states, if they're trying to get an amnesty done before June 30th, they may have a 30 or 45-day amnesty. Typical amnesties have been longer than that. We, again, based on our experience, think a 60-day amnesty is probably optimal time frame. It creates enough time to make taxpayers and the tax community aware of the tax amnesty, but it's not so long that it drags on forever. You want to make sure that it's an important priority for taxpayers and that you make them aware of it during a short time period. Third question, of course, is eligible tax types. Again, clearly a policy consideration. In Indiana, they included nearly every tax type that they have in Indiana. I think it, based on our experience and Jack's team, I think what we would say is that if you're going to do a tax amnesty and a broad-based general amnesty as opposed to a non-compliance program, then it's not inconceivable that a taxpayer who owes one tax type may owe a different tax type. I realize here in Oregon, of course, the predominant tax is the personal income tax, but the policy decision that you'll be faced with is whether or not to broaden it in an effort to generate revenue, and it really depends on what the legislature and the executive branch's goal is. If the goal is to generate revenue, then you might lean in the direction that Oregon did, or excuse me, that Indiana and Oklahoma did, which was to broaden the tax amnesty as broadly as possible. Fifth, what kinds of incentives does the state provide for taxpayers to come into compliance? Nearly every state waives all penalties, civil and criminal. The real discussion point comes around whether or not to waive interest, and if so, how much. We've seen across the landscape where states have waived all interest, and we've seen states waive no interest. I think based on our experience, our thought would be that the greater the incentive the taxpayer has to come into compliance, the more likely they are to come into compliance. But again, that's clearly a policy decision for lawmakers to make. That dovetails nicely into the sixth policy consideration, which is post-amnesty compliance. Obviously, vigorous post-amnesty compliance so that taxpayers who are not compliant or are thinking about not complying understand that the state is going to go after non-compliant taxpayers after an amnesty program. I know that's consistent with what I think the Department of Revenue said in their January report about going, making sure that they had aggressive compliance activities. But I think that another thing that the legislature should consider, and I know that it's contained in Senate Bill 880, is the notion of a greater penalty in the post-amnesty world than in the pre-amnesty world. And what I mean by that is for those taxpayers who are eligible to participate but who choose not to for whatever reason, the state could provide for a supplemental penalty for those taxpayers. In Senate Bill 880, it provides for an additional penalty of 25%. In Indiana, we saw a doubling of penalties. The bill that was just passed in Virginia provides for a 20% additional penalty. And of course, in addition to that, there will be post-amnesty litigation and audits that would continue in the post-amnesty environment. Seventh consideration is how to use media. I don't think that's really a question of whether you're going to use media, because in this day and age, everybody's going to do at least press releases and probably some electronic communications. The scope and size of a media, if you do paid media, I think the only consideration that one ought to have as a policymaker is to ensure that any paid media, and frankly earned media, is done in conjunction with your other tax collection efforts. So what I mean by that, in the world that we operate in, and if you'll turn to page 3 of the handout, the color handouts that we provided to you, you'll see this chart here, you'll see that there were a very significant number of outbound and inbound calls that were made, and this is from the Indiana Tax Amnesty and is material that's public available in their report on their post-amnesty report. But what you'll see is that the calls go in waves, both inbound and outbound, and that is driven by primarily two different factors. One is the contact that we're working on in conjunction with the Indiana Department of Revenue, both direct mail and telephone, and then the media. Jack says it's better than I do, but the last thing you want to do is have paid media on television and you don't have call representatives available to answer the phones at a time when you're, bless you, at a time when you're generating a lot of interest and attention on your program. So close coordination on media is very important to assure success. The last policy issue is resource allocation. Oregon's Department of Revenue is not different than any other Department of Revenue. They have a great staff, great resources, but when you take on a project that's as complicated and challenging as a tax amnesty, it really does push the department, any department, to its limit in terms of the their resources. And so the question is whether or not and how to use supplemental resources in an effort to supplement, not supplant, the work that the department will do. What we found, and again, you can look at that same chart number 3, you'll see that the volume of outbound calls is pretty significant. I think I referenced it already. We did 1 million outbound calls Some of them were auto dialers, some of them were direct dials with customer service representatives, designed to encourage people to take advantage of the amnesty opportunity. And finally, if you turn over to page four of the handout, you'll see that part of the success from the program came from the fact that 60% of taxes paid during the amnesty period came from out-of-state taxpayers, including some right here in Oregon. And I think the ability to complement the work that the department may do here in the state with out-of-state contacts is equally important to the success of an amnesty program. So with that, Madam Chair, I think that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to take your questions at this time. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for that presentation. What was, do you know what roughly the breakdown in Indiana, or maybe both, between corporate and individual tax was?
Yes. The information from Indiana was 60% was corporate, Madam Chair, and 40% was individual. The numbers from Oklahoma have not been released publicly yet, so it probably wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment, but I'm sure that Mr. Warren would be able to obtain that information from the Oklahoma Tax Commission.
So basically, given that information combined with the fact that 60% of the program revenues came from out-of-state taxpayers, is it fair to say that you collected a lot of corporate taxes that were owed from maybe multi-state companies or companies that were based out of state?
I believe that is a fair statement, Senator. Yeah.
And was your outreach strategy the same for corporations and individuals?
It was, Madam Chair, it was the same in the sense that we actively made outbound calls to both individuals and corporations. Where it differed is really with the times that we placed the calls and to what parties within the entity we tried to reach. Calling an individual, you know, we were calling person to person, calling within the corporation. There were strategies used to call officers of the company, things of that nature.
And when you say corporations, you're talking about C corporations and S corporations?
That is correct, Madam Chair. Okay.
Do you have any idea what the breakdown might be between C and S corporations in Indiana?
I don't, Madam Chair, at the top of my fingertips. We could certainly put that together and report back to you.
I'm just curious. Let's see. The other thing is estate taxes. Did you spend any time focusing on estate taxes?
We did spend a little bit of time focusing on estate taxes.
Okay, and what kind of return did you get?
Again, Madam Chair, I apologize. I don't have those specific numbers. They were a very small piece of the amnesty.
All right, questions from the committee? Senator Hass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a better time to do this when you look at economic recessions versus non-recessions? For example, if we were to do this, say, next fall, it would seem to me that there may be a lot of people who would be in this category just because they've lost their job, and if they and even though they might want to participate, if they can't afford to pay they still can't participate. So I was just wondering if it makes more sense to if a recession is an advantageous time to do this versus non-recession.
Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, I think what we tend to see is that more states do them during economic downturns. We could look back at the data and see if there are states that have done them outside of it. I mean, for example, I think I mentioned that 19 states did them in 2002, 2003, and there were some pretty remarkable successes in that. There were some that were not as successful. Indiana's recession was later than most states. There was in the 2004 time period, and so they did their amnesty at the tail end of their post 9/11 recession, which was in 2005. And obviously, you've heard the results of that project. In Oklahoma, they experienced a downturn last year as oil prices came down because a lot of their revenue was generated from the oil and gas industry in Oklahoma. So I think the answer is it's hard to tell because most of the data indicates that states are doing these during economic downturns, which leads me to conclude that they're using them as revenue, ways to collect revenue.
Thank you. Follow up.
Please.
I may have missed it here, but of the states where amnesty's been tried, are there some who have lost on the deal?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, I'm not aware of states that have ended up spending more on an amnesty project than they collected. There are certainly states that set a goal that have come short of the goal. And it's difficult to tell whether or not they fell what the reasons were why they fell short of the goal, whether it was their outreach program, whether it was the economic conditions, as you already alluded to, or whether it was something else. Every state, as you know, is a little bit different, and so every state is going to both implement a tax amnesty differently and also have different eligibility requirements and things like that. So I think the short answer to your question is I'm not aware of any state that's come up short having spent more than they took in.
Thank you.
On this goal setting, we have a quirky, to say the least, tax code in Oregon, which makes it pretty important that we forecast as accurately as possible how much money is going to come in. And your forecast, delightfully enough, in Indiana was about four times higher than the goal. And in Oklahoma, it was closer to five times beyond the goal, which is a wonderful tribute to you. However, in Oregon, that would be kind of a mixed blessing, to say the least. Have you, given these two experiences, have you refined your goal setting to the point where you could be more accurate?
Madam Chair, let me answer the question this way. What we have done in each of the states is to go in, work with the State Department of Revenue to assess what their book of outstanding receivables are, and then based on our experience in other states, you know, New Jersey, Colorado, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, a bunch of the states that we collect in, look at the asset classes in question and assess what we think, based on our experience and our analytics, those receivables are likely, what rate those receivables are likely to liquidate at. You don't really know until you're done with the project how successful it's going to be, but certainly our decision making and our analytics is informed by our prior experiences.
Because we're literally in a situation where we really could lose revenue if the forecasting is not correct.
Well, Madam Chair, if I might just add one other point. I mean, frankly, in both cases, in neither case did we make the original estimate. The original estimates were done by the legislature in Indiana. The legislature came up with the original estimate, and in Oklahoma, that was an executive branch determination. We worked with both of those states after those estimates were out in an effort to try and figure out what we thought the number would be based on our experience in other asset classes in other states. But those estimates, the 65 and the 22 million in Indiana and Oklahoma, respectively, were state estimates. They were not ours.
Okay. Senator Morris, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you've already covered this, then I'll pick it up later. But did you discuss the terms of contract and performance?
We haven't as a committee yet. I did a little bit yesterday, but go ahead and
okay.
ask.
I would be curious how you typically structure your agreements with the states that you serve.
Sure. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, it's a great question. As we indicated, Jack's in our contingency service group. Most of our work with state governments, with governments in general, is on a contingency basis. Every state is a little bit different, but our goal is to align the state's interest and our interest so that the more we collect, the better the state is, but because it's a contingency fee, we would be paid from proceeds. But from a state's perspective, the benefit is no out-of-pocket expenses. So we would assume all the costs of all the direct mail, all the outbound calling, all the staffing, all that would be part of, assuming that was the direction that the state wanted to go. But I think every state has a slightly different approach, and we certainly would, if the state was looking for a public-private partnership, we would be happy to have that conversation. But it would be consistent with what the state already does with its private collection agencies today.
Just as a follow-up, are you comfortable elaborating beyond that, or is this something that if we do an RFP, then you would address it at that time?
We would certainly, Madam Chair or Mr. Vice Chair, we'd certainly welcome the opportunity to compete for a public-private partnership. I'm not sure if there's something specific that you were looking for.
Madam Chair, specifically what I was thinking is you know, in terms of a range of what your success fee, your contingency fee?
Oh, well, I can tell you that in Indiana, it's a publicly available number. I believe in Indiana for the $255 million, I think the total amount that the General Revenue Corporation, which is the subsidiary of ours, that was $13 million, I believe, for that project. And just to give you some context for that today, the Department of Revenue pays its private collection agencies those are all bid fees, but in the 16, 18, 19% range. So, as I said, the fee structure would be, assuming that those were the kinds of terms, I mean, it's sort of hard to negotiate a fee structure in a public setting, but I think that...
Well, that's why I guarded my question.
Well, and I appreciate it, but I think you're comfortable saying that it's a kind of a tiered fee structure where you make a certain amount up to a certain point and then you get a better fee if it surpasses that.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
That puts it in the ballpark.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On one of your, I guess it's the last of your colored handout slides, it says that 60% of the program revenues came from out-of-state taxpayers. That's across the board in all of these states?
No, I'm sorry.
That's in Indiana.
Yeah.
And is that typical of what states experience? I mean, I wouldn't think that the revenue that states bring in is generally that disproportionate. So,
yes.
So is that unique to Indiana's tax structure, or is it something you'd expect to find in a state like ours?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I think the experience is going to vary across states. Hopefully Oklahoma's report will be available soon and we'll be able to provide the committee with additional data from that report. I mean, frankly, Indiana's report was very detailed in terms of the information that it provided. I think you have some information from the state of Iowa before you that Mr. Warner has provided to you. I don't believe it was as high a percentage, but it was a significant percentage. And not as high as Indiana. But I think what it underscores is that there is opportunity to collect taxes from people who don't live in Oregon because they either do business in Oregon or they have moved from Oregon without coming into compliance with an outstanding liability. And so I think what it underscores is there is an opportunity to collect uncollected receivables beyond the borders of the state.
Okay. All right. Any questions? Senator Telfer, you surely must have some questions.
Have you found, and it isn't directly, it's not direct to your job or your process, but have you found where amnesty programs have hurt a state's compliance in subsequent years, meaning it's minimized it or reduced the compliance rate in subsequent years to an amnesty program?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I think there are ways a state can mitigate that. I think we talked about several of them. I think Senate Bill 880 has one of them in there already. Number one, I think you can provide for additional penalties for those taxpayers who are eligible to participate in the amnesty but who did not. I think that you can ensure that you have a vigorous post-amnesty compliance program designed to include audits and litigation for those taxpayers who, again, were eligible but did not participate. Other states have done things like put a statutory limit. Iowa did this, that said, we're not going to do a tax amnesty for 20 years, and they put that in the statute. And I think there are... there are other things, and it certainly would be up to policymakers to make this determination, but, for example, if the tax amnesty program generated sufficient revenue that it went exceeded, for example, let's say you budgeted a certain amount of that money for, as the chair was alluding to, for a particular project or for general fund, and it exceeded that, potentially a state could take those resources and put that into compliance as a way to mitigate it. But we have not seen any evidence about adverse impacts on compliance. That doesn't mean that there's not data out there, but I'm not aware of any that has shown that.
To follow up, just so you get your sound bite, you know, we talked about collecting receivables, because I've said that, you know, the number one thing to do is collect that which is already owed you. And this is just another tool in the toolbox that says, well, these dollars are owed to us too. We're just going to be a little bit more proactive in discovering what they are and who they're owed by. So.
Right. Thank you for the sound bite, Senator.
Yeah.
That's an important one.
I'm trying to get it to you before you ask. So.
Okay. I always like to not have to ask. So to your knowledge, when the amnesty is over, have the states tended to use part of the proceeds to improve their existing compliance operations, or do you even know, do you follow that?
Madam Chair, it just depends on the state. It's widely varied. I mean, I certainly think that in Indiana, Governor Daniels took the proceeds from the tax amnesty above the $65 million, pardon me, and put that into all-day kindergarten. I think it just depends on the state's priority.
We're not going to do that, I don't think.
Madam Chair, I wasn't making a policy recommendation.
It sounds like a wonderful idea.
Sounds like a wonderful idea, for the record.
This is Mr. All-Day Kindergarten sitting right next to me here. Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much. Are there any other questions from the committee? Anything that you wanted to add that we have forgotten to ask?
I don't think so. Madam Chair, I'll just make a couple of quick comments as we leave the witness table up. Genuinely thank you for this time and the chance to talk to you about what our experience. We really appreciate it. Secondly, there are some questions you asked, and we'll get you answers. We will respond and follow up the way to those that you already asked. And if anything else comes to your mind, please feel free to get in touch with me, and we'll get the answers from Sally Mae for you as quick as we can, because we know you have interest in at least considering what you're going to do with this, and so we'll be happy to help you further. But for today, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I have one follow-up question.
And me too.
Excuse me for prolonging this, but have any of the states included local governments, counties and cities, so you're dealing with it in a comprehensive way in the state?
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, the one that I'm aware of that's including local governments right now is the state of Connecticut. I'm not aware that any other states that have, but that doesn't mean going back into the 80s that there might not have been. I think just so you think about the policy considerations there, putting aside the politics of the local governments, there are certainly operational issues, not that are insurmountable, but they're probably going to have a different information technology platform. Their collection systems may be different. Their processes may be different. Doesn't mean you can't integrate them, but it's just one more step, and I think it really is a function of timing. If you have enough time to build that process and that system, you can accomplish anything. But it just makes it a more complicated amnesty program, but that doesn't mean it's not doable.
We discussed yesterday, we actually collect the TriMet tax at the state level, and so that's one that you could collect with a with the state platform.
And Madam Chair, I think the other thing is any tax fine fee that goes through the state already today, you could theoretically lump into a statewide tax amnesty. I mean, if you're going to publicize it and you're going to work through the effort, if you decide to go down this path, It's not that challenging. What we have seen in some other states, though, is when the state is doing an amnesty, the locals may decide to do it at the same time, not necessarily in conjunction with, but simultaneous, to sort of take advantage of the attention and energy that's going into amnesty.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rosenthal.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that you said typically a 60-day period is the amnesty period itself, but how long does it generally take when a state would decide to embark on an amnesty before we're actually in that 60-day period? How much planning time do we need?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I'm going to let my colleague, Mr. Frazier, answer that one because he has to do it.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, when we typically partner with a state, we like to have at least 60 days between a contract signing and when the amnesty period begins, so we can do some pre-work. We like to get the inventory 30 to 45 days ahead of time to begin our skip tracing efforts. There's a training period we need to go through with our staff that's 3 or 4 weeks long. And there's a lot of work that we like to do ahead of time so that, you know, when the whistle blows, it's full speed ahead. And for the next 60 days, we're concentrating on talking to as many taxpayers as we can, versus working out system issues. Typically, a state will ask us for a series of reports. Those reports need to be programmed, they need to be tested, they need to be reviewed. We need to put together training material that meets a state's needs. That needs to be reviewed and approved. Scripts that we use when we're speaking to taxpayers, just all of that sort of stuff needs to be done in the 60-ish days prior to an amnesty period beginning.
Madam Chair and Senator Rizmo, I should be remiss, though, if I didn't say that Mr. Frazier is actually working on another state's tax amnesty program right now that is going to give him less than 60 days to do it. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the Vice Chair's question. You can do anything if you put your mind to it. It's just optimally you'd like to have 60 days prior to an amnesty to ensure it maximizes success.
Thank you.
Are you telling us you want us to stop talking so you can go to get back to work?
No, ma'am.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Very educational. Thank you. Okay, we will close the informational hearing now and open up a hearing on Senate Bill 880, which is the actual amnesty bill. Dr. Warner.
Madam Chair, the Senate Bill 880, when we requested a draft from council for this as a committee bill, what we did was ask for just a duplication of what was Senate Bill 480 from the 2005 session, Senate Bill 480C. There was a number of other components to the original 480, 480A, but it had been scaled down after the third committee. It went through that session to just a general amnesty program. There's one other element in there that mandates withholding of income taxes on retirement income, and that's an issue that you may not want to include in this. So the 880 is really kind of a starting point for you, kind of at the stopping point for the 05 revenue committees who spent a lot of time on this. So, and they went through a whole series of decisions. Most of those that Mr. Heyman laid out for you. And around decisions about who to include in particular, and 880 just includes essentially designed to try to find individuals who have not been in the system, that are non-filers or have not participated in the income tax system. So the focus of the committee, and they did a lot of discussions about how to treat delinquent tax payments, how to treat individuals that the department was aware of but had liabilities, and what kinds of measures to use. And the decision was to focus on these longer-term taxpayers or potential taxpayers that were not part of the system. That's where the feeling was, that's where the long-term revenue was, where you get the net gain, whereas much of the gain from tracking down individuals that the department is aware of are largely timing gains. Not to say that might not be important in particular fiscal situations, but that was the decision of the committee at that time. They also went for a period of July 1 to September 30th for an amnesty period. This is based on discussions with the Department of Revenue. Their main concern at that time was not to put something in place at the same time they're doing the processing. So that's why the bill has that time frame. It could easily be moved back, or it could be moved up to 2009 if that's something that the committee wants to look at to fit into that Labor Day to Thanksgiving Day recommended time frame. The committee also chose to have a 25% post-amnesty penalty. It did not waive interest on participants in the amnesty program. It just waived penalties and then imposed this additional penalty afterwards. I have provided some background information for you. The Iowa tax amnesty program, as the chair pointed out, corporate income was a high percentage of that. So that could be an issue for you to talk about whether you want to incorporate corporate income taxpayers into this potential amnesty, because the 05 effort just had personal tax income taxpayers, but that was largely due to the fact that the original bill had a voluntary compliance initiative in it. which was really aimed at corporate taxpayers. So it was a different setting and a different combination of policies at that time. So that's certainly something you may want to look at again. I also have just a summary from the Federation of Tax Administrators that shows you all of the amnesties that have been in place going back to 1982. So that's just kind of a chronology. And the last thing I wanted to mention is, if you look on the back of your 880 draft measure summary, on the back side of that, I just Xeroxed off a copy of a revenue impact that we had done. And I know it doesn't seem like a lot, but it took many hours of blood, sweat, and tears to come up with these estimates. But the fortunate thing for us in terms of looking at these estimates, we have a lot of information from other states. Department of Revenue now, their research unit, is kind of set up a spreadsheet for us to look at where they've been tracking these, and we can put them in some kind of a scaling relationship with Oregon, for example, this Iowa example or the Indiana example, and show what percentage of collection do they actually raise through the amnesty and try to go from there. So we're not operating from scratch. The hardest thing for us at the time was to try to make this distinction between what would we have collected under current law versus what we would get in terms of gross revenue. And you can see that's what I tried to do in this impact statement. We had estimated in that biennium we'd get about a little less than $13 million as gross revenue from these unidentified taxpayers. And these are the people that weren't in the system that we estimated would come in. A lot of this was based on a Michigan study, which was very detailed at that time, that we used for those estimates. And then we assumed that you'd get about $2.83 million long-term revenue gain, but we also assumed that you would be pulling some people into the amnesty period that the department would have tracked down anyway. That's why I plugged in that minus 3.2. And then over time, we anticipated that there would be some increase from the 25% post-amnesty penalty. So that's how we netted all of that out, and we came up with $10.1 million. So for us, it's what our task is to try to come up for you what we would consider to be a net increase to the forecast. So we want to add that net that would not have been collected otherwise. It's a net increase to the amount that was generated. A lot of states will report their amnesty totals on a gross. You know, everything, all the money that came in that 30-day or 90-day period, which without adjusting for some estimate of what would have come in anyway. So that's the art form of this, and what we try to get to give you what would be our best guess at how much this program would actually add to the net revenue forecast that you could budget against.
So when you figure out what would have come in anyway, do you kind of go back in history and figure out what percentage of delinquent accounts, for example, or I guess these were non-filers, but what percentage you'd experienced before and base it on that?
Madam Chair, that's right. We had those same delinquent reports that you received last week that the department prepared, so we know what's kind of in the hopper. And what we did was assume kind of a normal rate of collection off of that amount. And so we assume that some of that would have been pulled forward. So we use those kind of proportions.
Thank you. Do we have anybody signed up on this, on Senate Bill 880? Well, would any committee members like to go testify? Okay, well, I guess the informational hearing was so stunning that we were left speechless. So was the audience. Deborah, did you have anything you wanted to add on this? Maybe you could give us a little perspective on why it was settled to, go for non-filers instead of delinquent people, unless I misunderstood Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue, and with me I have Gary Humphrey, who's manager of the program services section for the personal income tax, and he's been involved in a lot of the discussions at the agency about an amnesty. And you were correct that the focus in 2005 was on the non-filers, and it as far as I know, it was just a policy decision of the legislature to focus on that instead of including the accounts receivable.
But from the Department of Revenue standpoint, there wouldn't be any logistical problem with including delinquencies, both corporate and individual, would there?
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, Gary Humphrey from the Department of Revenue. And when we've been talking about it, I don't know of any logistical difficulties to answer your question about adding corporations or expanding some of this. None that we've identified.
Okay. And how would you go about, if we pass something like this, how would you go about determining the goal, the amnesty goal?
So, Madam Chair, the dollar amount of the goal?
The goal. You know, they gave us information about Indiana had set a goal and Oklahoma had set a goal of what they thought they could reasonably get. And I'm just wondering how you would go about figuring that out.
Well, I think from what we've talked about before, in working between our research section and with Paul and his staff is how we would come up with some kind of a revenue goal. So it'd be a joint effort between LRO and Department of Revenue.
I guess you'd do it, huh, Paul? That's where all things seem to end up. Senator Telford.
Well, thank you. Given that, how different would it be than your quick, maybe it wasn't so quick, $10 million? I mean, how much different do you think that will be when you get down to dotting I's and crossing T's?
Senator Telford, no, it was not quick.
Well,
so I also noticed the date on this.
Sure,
noticed the date on this, July 11th. It depends on those kinds of parameters that you set. I don't think it would be a whole lot different estimate today if you limited it to personal income taxes, if you limited it to unidentified taxpayers, if you just limited it or just offered penalties except for and required interest on those collections. So, you know, if you made all these same policy decisions, I don't think it would be too much different. There would be some scaling up just because of growth over time and total income tax liability, but I don't think it would be radically different. Where you get into the differences is when you start making adjustments in the policy decisions. For example, do you include corporate income taxpayers? Do you decide to waive interest as well as penalties? Do you include those delinquent accounts in those estimates? If you include delinquent accounts, that gross number blows up. It gets much bigger. But then the trick, of course, becomes how much of that, what would have been the time frame and how much of that would the department have collected. And what we do is we work with them to try to get a good estimate of kind of this counterfactual assumption about if we hadn't passed this bill, what would they have been expecting? And then we make that adjustment.
Madam Chair, follow-up, please. A few meetings ago, we talked about the accounts receivable and that they were fairly... I think that my impression was that the department is doing a good job in collecting those, and so there wasn't a whole lot of concern, which is why I had raised it to begin with. Given that, do you see a reason why we would fold it into this process?
Senator, you know, I think really the main reason is a timing issue, so that if you think it's imperative to pull revenue forward into the present period, and that may be, a way to get through a deep cyclical downturn. That is one of that is probably the biggest motive that states have, particularly those that are on fiscal year budgets.
So it's more like an offer and compromise.
Well, right. It's a timing, trying to pull that revenue forward, and we, you know, typically the states have done this. We've done it in the past here, with other elements, trying to speed up payments, just so we can get through some of these cyclical downturns, and because all of our budgeting is done on a cash basis.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like that we have a pretty large, I guess you might say, source of data from the 43 states. And I noticed the time, that some of these go back quite a ways. But in my former life, one of the things we did is we benchmarked extensively. and we our theme was steal shamelessly but say thank you. and I'm wondering if by way of the policy direction, if we were to examine the other states that have gone through this, what have they learned, what worked, what didn't work, and then compile the best practices into the policy bill and then move that forward. I mean, obviously our goal is to recapture that unpaid and due tax liability, and what's worked and what hasn't worked, and then put that into the policy bill and then go with it.
And Senator, and I think that that's certainly another factor that could influence our revenue estimate is, you know, what is the anticipated amount of resources that the legislature will put into this outreach effort, because I think that's a real critical element as well. How much you bring in is how aware people are. So we would factor that in as well. If there's, you know, very little budgeted toward outreach, we would suspect we'd get less of a response than if you put together a package that was something close to what we've seen in some of these other states that had a bigger response. So that becomes a variable in the amount of, it's an expenditure, but it also influences the amount of revenue you get bring in.
Right. Okay, we now have a soundbite for Senator Morris. Steal shamelessly, but say thank you.
Well, it works, Madam Chair.
You'll be called upon to repeat that. Okay, any other questions of Paul or the department?
Thank you
very much. To be continued. We will close the. Anybody else decide they want to say anything? We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 880, and this one for sure will be back committee, and we are adjourned.
I have lots of good news. The Indiana report.
Yeah, we